This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, and thank you for joining us for our broadcast and online Main Street across North Dakota. And it's Friday, and it's 2021. It's a brand new year, so we're going to continue our look back at 2020 and the big story of the year, which was COVID-19 and how it affected so many of our enterprises and agencies across the state of North Dakota, worldwide for that matter. And today we're checking in with Nick Hacker. He is the chair of the North Dakota Board of Higher Education. Nick, thanks for joining us today.
You bet, Doug. Happy to be with you, and thank you for having us on.
How long have you been chairing the board?
At this point, about 18 months.
Now, as I mentioned, the pandemic was the big challenge for everyone in 2020. It continues into 2021. Give us a sort of an overall assessment of how COVID-19 affected higher education in North Dakota.
I would classify it as a very large and fast changing pivot in how we deliver education, in particular higher education in the state. There's opportunities that come with disruption, and we're excited to see those out into the future.
Well, what opportunities came from this disruption?
Sure. So higher education's really been under some pressure to evolve or transform, and from a high-level perspective, I would say that the pandemic forced that discussion and forced action and really advanced higher education, I believe, anywhere from a decade to two decades into the future.
And this was something I think that Governor Doug Burgum had been advocating, some of the changes you may be referring to.
Oh, definitely. And the governor and I have had a number of conversations about the future of higher education and what we were doing today, and that was even prior to the pandemic, and I think that a magnifying glass came out and said, okay, here's kind of the wheres and the hows, and the hows are what are challenging, and how do you do those things? But it's really kind of I see it as an exciting time. It was a very challenging time, obviously, for the last two, the end of the spring semester, and then of course this last fall semester. We needed to adapt and adapt quickly, really on two fronts. And one is how do we be safe, and how do we ensure that we're continuing to strive towards student success. At the same time, and the other side was really an advancement of technology.
Well, the very obvious change that resulted almost immediately from COVID-19 was a lot of online instruction. But give us a sense of how this transformational process you referred to will be apparent this year or in years future. What kinds of major or changes are you suggesting we'll be seeing in the way higher education is delivered?
I'm happy to dive into that, Doug. And obviously, we're talking more online type of delivery. What we're finding in this process, and I think we should go back to March of last year in a moment, but what we're finding is that students are looking for an on-campus experience in general, not all the time, but in general, they're looking for this on-campus experience and support that occurs when you're on campus. At the same time, they want to take some classes online. And they want to be, they want a flexible type of schedule. And so it's not necessarily they're desiring purely an online experience or purely an in-person faculty and student experience. It's really an on-campus more of experience that they're looking for.
Well, we'll get into some more details on that in a moment, but let's backtrack to the big story. What is the status of COVID on North Dakota's higher education campuses? That is, testing, have there been any cases, any hospitalizations or deaths related to higher education in the state? And for that matter, I saw a reference on one of your agendas recently for COVID fatigue.
Well, Doug, I think we're all feeling
yes,
COVID fatigue, and students are no different. And we're all tired of Zoom, and we want to, we all look forward to more in-person engagement. you know, when we look back, we took an approach in March that I think really set us up for some success in dealing with the pandemic. And so when we look back to March, and things were very uncertain. If you recall, nobody really knew what the virus did or how it passed from person to person. And of course, by now we know so much more about the virus, but this was back when everything was fresh and new and very unknown. And at that time, the board really took an approach that said, we believe the best decisions are made locally within our campuses. And so we really pushed forward delegation down to the campus level. And part of that was is that each campus is so dynamically different. Your experience at NDSU and the type of courses you're taking there are very different than the State College of Science down in Wahpeton or in Botno. And so what we knew right away was that no one size will fit all. And what really occurred was we only came out with one ultimate mandate at that time, and it was based on feedback that we had received from experts, and that was ensuring that masks helped. And so we didn't mandate masks. Again, a one-size-fits-all also didn't work. Imagine a welding course at College of Science where you're being required to wear a paper mask. That would be very dangerous. And so we directed each institution to adopt a mask policy that fit for their campus. And ultimately, that was the only real mandate that came from the board. And I think it was the governance structure that we kind of set out on that led to each individual's campus ability to adapt, fairly successfully. And the way we did that is we delegated down, as I mentioned, but we also created a task force immediately. We identified that we have some really top talent in the medical fields in North Dakota, especially with Dr. Nguyen at the medical school, as well as Dr. Carson, who's an infectious disease specialist down at NDSU. And so we created the task force, and we brought all of the interested parties together with leading experts in the field to gather input and feedback on a weekly basis and sometimes multiple times a week. And so they were engaging not only with faculty and staff and each institution's leadership, but also students. Students were a vital part of how we developed protocols by campus and how they were engaged with. And I really need to highlight Member Solberg's engagement, Erica Solberg, who's our student member of the board, and, showing up and delivering, being the conduit of communication between what the students' desires and wants were and what we were needing to do from a protective standpoint.
Well, let's switch gears here a bit and talk about funding. Have there been adjustments to budgets? I mean, to accommodate COVID protocols, mitigating the pandemic, and reduce tuition perhaps, or some disruption in terms of attendance, student housing and food service and other fee-based campus funding sources. Give us an overview of the money piece of higher education.
Sure. So each institution kind of handled that as it relates to room and board, on their own. But as far as tuition goes, we maintained and continued to deliver education. And so there really was no major shift in any type of refund on tuition. By headcount, we didn't really see much of a change between our fall enrollment and our prior enrollment. We are down in enrollment 2020 versus kind of 2017 and 18 by about 4%. But what we saw during this time, and then we could attribute that to some students delaying or taking a semester off. Now, other states have seen much bigger swings in those numbers. However, I would say that the number of degrees awarded from that same 2017-18 compared to what we awarded in degrees during the pandemic was only down by about 15 total degrees. So what that tells you is students that had started and they were nearing that late sophomore, junior, senior years. They stuck with it through an online, you know, or a hybrid type of model. But yeah, we kind of stuck with it, and we really haven't seen a massive decline in enrollment. We have seen a little bit. We want to be honest here, but not earth shattering, and something we should be able to deal with.
You mentioned that tuition hasn't been significantly affected, but that campus experience has been significantly affected. Is tuition going to be revisited if this continues at the, it's going to be a while till everybody gets vaccinated?
Yeah, I think it will be a while until everybody gets vaccinated. What we're seeing, though, is that, as I mentioned at the beginning, is the students are desiring a campus experience, maybe not an in-person education experience, but an on-campus experience. And so the services that go along with that are really, still mostly intact. And part of that was also back to that March meeting, March-April timeframe. So the March meeting, we started the COVID discussion, and by the April meeting, we had enough information to say, we believe we can safely return to campus in the fall. And, through testing and safe protocols, we were able to return all of our students and open our campuses back up in late August for the fall semester. And so we're really trying to get back to kind of that new normal, if you want to call it. So I don't expect any major declines in any cuts to tuition necessarily. And so tuition is fairly stable.
I was looking at your most recent board agenda, and behavioral health was near the top of the list there. Expand on that and the need for that.
So even pre-COVID, we were starting to see the needs of students were evolving and changing. And I think this is probably true for the greater populace of the citizens. But behavioral health and addiction and treatment has been on the increase. What we found when we ran preliminary numbers was that it really kind of spiked during the pandemic. It's a very challenging time psychologically for a lot of people, probably all of us included. And so what we had to do in the middle of a pandemic is how do we deliver those services more through a telemental health? And we launched more telemental health opportunities throughout the system to try to meet that need that has been increasing. We care for our students and we care for their health, and we're here to educate the whole and not just deliver comp 101.
Over the years, the North Dakota Board of Higher Education has had a number of set tos with the North Dakota legislature. The legislature has now reconvened. Most recently, there was Constitutional Measure Number 1, which went down to overwhelming defeat, but that would have changed the makeup of the board and the length of terms and all that kind of thing. What are your priorities in interfacing with the legislature during this session?
Yeah. We're excited to have the legislature back in session. It's always an opportunity for us to look at challenges and try to find solutions. And we're really excited on the financial front with the legislature back in session. We're looking at our needs-based budget with an understanding of the challenges that the state faces financially. We want to be a good partner, but we also want to, show why the investment and why meeting a needs-based budget is important for higher education. But we are a good partner. Second to that is, the governor announced in his State of the State address a desire to develop bring a group of folks together, the legislative leadership, the governor's office, and as well as higher education, to try to find a way that we could create a type of stabilization fund. And to study that and to develop maybe a model in which it might be something similar to K-12. And so financial stability is always kind of on the forefront when we head into a legislative session. Additionally, we're continuing to look at, transformational innovation and how we not only deliver but what we're delivering. So open educational resources, which has saved students millions of dollars, actually, by this point, since we went down that path on their books. How do we continue to advance open educational resources? how do we refine this high, and then how do we refine this hybrid delivery model, which is some online, some in person, et cetera. And then also, you know, how do we capitalize on the disruption? And we have four of our presidents stepped up to vet an idea that we think could be very, very different and transformational for not only North Dakota, but we think could put us in a top tier of states in content development, in which we're working, you know, we call it eCore or electronic curriculum open resources. So kind of like OER, but as faculty are developing content for online delivery, why can't other faculty borrow or use the best content that's already been created within an entire system? And so that's being really vetted through at this point and studied. And then how do we do that with the support and maybe the rewarding of faculty that create the best content? And so we're really excited about where this potentially could go. Lots of hurdles, of course, but we're very focused on how we transform into the future through this disruptive time. And then our third kind of pillar is increased student support, as we talked about mental health. But that's also scholarship support. Challenge Grant has been highly successful, and Career Builders, which began last session in the last 2 years here in this last biennium, to advance in-demand training and education, where it's a partnership with the private sector, as well as the state to give a scholarship to students in high-demand areas that those businesses and industry desire to fill. And then also, how do we advance more dual credit? And maybe looking at currently and today, high school students are paying tuition to attain dual credit, and it becomes a little bit of a disincentive in attaining the dual credit. And maybe there's ways that we can look at funding that in a unique way to encourage more dual credit.
Well, those are ways to lower the cost of higher education to the student and family as well. And, of course, that's an issue nationwide. Are there other innovations that North Dakota can look at in terms of keeping the cost down so that students don't graduate with crushing debt?
Absolutely. And I think that's one of the main, you know, that's in our strategic plan, really, is affordability. We are finding great success in public and private partnerships, in which we're able to, a good example is the University of North Dakota replaced all 22 of its boilers through a public-private partnership. And so we didn't have to replace 22 boilers, and that total cost would have been $90 million. And instead of putting $90 million on the backs of the students and taxpayers, we entered a partnership to lower that and save a lot of money. So we are very focused on affordability, and we think we call them PPPs, public-private partnerships. We think that's a part of our future success.
Nick Hacker is chair of the North Dakota Board of Higher Education. And, Nick, I appreciate you spending some time with us today. I'm sure we'll be chatting again.
Well, I appreciate your time, Doug, and thank you guys so much for all the work you do.
Coming up on Main Street, a Plainsfolk essay with Tom Ezern.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Basin Electric Power Cooperative, headquartered in Bismarck, a Touchstone energy cooperative generating and delivering electricity to over 3 million consumers in 9 states, spanning from the Canadian to Mexican border.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Tom Ezern is a Main Street regular. His Plainsfolk essays draw from his expertise about the history of where we live and his skill in writing and presenting ideas. Tom also loves music. He sings, plays guitar, and researches musical traditions of the Great Plains. Today, his essay is titled Songcatcher.
Songcatcher. It's the title of a year 2000 film recently viewed at our house on Willow Creek. It stars Janet McTeer as Professor Lily Penlerick, a musicologist enamored of the ballad tradition. She stumbles into a mountain community of singers in North Carolina, becomes entangled with their lives as well as their music, and is transformed. The film received mixed reviews, but it intrigues me because of its historic content. The title character is based on one Olive Dame Campbell, a real-life songcatcher. A century ago, songcatchers, ballad hunters, seekers and recorders of folk music traditions roamed the country, trying to save what they believed to be dying cultures, generally in remote places. The American prairies were a fertile frontier for their work. Understand that there was an academic establishment in the fraternity of songcatchers, a sort of club headquartered in eastern places with ivy on their walls, more specifically Harvard University. Tweedy names like Francis James Child, George Lyman Kittredge, and Francis Barton Grummer dominated the field. So as songcatchers worked the Great Plains, they not only accumulated collections, but also were part of a struggle for identity. Cowboy songs were a visible battleground. There were a lot of them, and they appealed to the popular imagination. First in the field was N. Howard Thorpe, who self-published his collection, Songs of the Cowboys, in 1908. This is a valuable work, but Thorpe had no academic chops, and so he is not part of the struggle over ballads I'm talking about. But John Lomax was. A Texas boy who did graduate work with Kittredge at Harvard, he published Cowboy Songs and Other Frontier Ballads in 1910. This is the most significant work of a songcatcher on the Great Plains. But if you know the backstory, there is tension there. Lomax brought Western balladry to Harvard, but he also took Harvard home with him. You see, Kittredge and company had some quaint ideas about ballads. They loved to think of them as relics of primitive tribal peoples expressing a charming rustic character, but lacking artistic merit. Lomax often spoke about how his cowboy ballads were in this tradition. But think about it. This is insulting to the people of the plains. It makes them into anthropological museum curiosities. Meanwhile, song catching took hold up and down the plains. North Dakota had two ballad hunters, the sadly short-lived Franz Rickaby at the University of North Dakota, and the eclectic scholar George Will of Bismarck. They were not fixed on cowboy ballads, so they broadened the field both in geography and in content. Women, too, contrary to the male exclusivity of Harvard, collected prairie ballads. Myra Hull at the University of Kansas is a neglected figure in this respect, one I must write about in a future contribution. The star of my current story, however, is Louise Pound, a Lincoln, Nebraska girl who got herself a PhD from Heidelberg and came home to unsettle the academic establishment at the University of Nebraska. She was the Wonder Woman of her generation, a world-class athlete in several sports, and the first female president of the Modern Language Association. She not only made a great collection of ballads from the Central Plains, but also assailed, in print, the arrogant ideas of the Harvard crowd. The singers of the plains, she insisted, were imaginative artists deserving of recognition for their creative work as persons, not as tribes. So, although the press of her day often insisted on referring to Louise Pound as Miss Pound, she is always Dr. Pound to me. Dr. Louise Pound, songcatcher.
That's Tom Ezard. Coming up on Main Street, News Director Dave Thompson recaps the week's big stories, and Matt Olean reviews the new movie, Promising Young Woman.
Join Prairie Public Thursday, January 21st for a premier online screening and panel discussion of Esta es mi casa, This is My Home, Prairie Public's original documentary about the journeys of the Red River Valley's Hispanic communities. Generations ago, they came to help with the harvest. Today, their children and grandchildren contribute their own cultural stamp to our region's art, cuisine, diversity, and economy. That's Thursday, January 21st at 7 p.m. Central. Please RSVP for this online event at prairiepublic.org.
Well, there's that ancient wire machine in the background, which means it's time for a couple of battered news veterans to chat about the big stories of the week. Dave Thompson, Prairie Public's news director, joins us every Friday to talk about this. And, Dave, we haven't had a conversation in several weeks.
No, so we haven't.
I'm glad
nice
to be
talk
back
to you.
With you.
Yes, thanks.
Well, let's talk about that huge story of the week that overwhelmed everything else, as it turns out, even COVID-19.
And it
that
certainly
was the
did.
Assault on the U.S. Capitol, for heaven's sakes.
If I can share a quick personal story on that, I was actually here writing a story. You know, I was writing over the noon hour, you know, to get stuff ahead and go back to the legislature. I had the television on in the background, and I happened to look up just as the siege started. And I felt kind of heartsick because it took me back, believe it or not, to 9/11,
yeah,
and that whole feeling I had during 9/11. It was just, what is going on here? And we still got reverberations that are going to be around for a while about what might be happening in terms of security. I think the one thing that I'm feeling personally is that I visit the Capitol a lot when I'd go to D.C., you know, for meetings and or go out and see the congressional delegation. Now it's going to be harder to see the congressional delegation, and probably the Capitol will be fairly inaccessible. And I'm sad to see that, but I understand why.
Yeah, I have to tell you that I share that concern because it is absolutely a wonderful experience to walk into the U.S. Capitol.
Yes, it is.
It's full of history. It's magnificent. It's a shame, a real shame. Now, our congressional delegation, as it turned out, no one was harmed in the delegation.
Correct.
Five people have died as a result of this assault on the Capitol. But the interesting thing about it politically was that they were going to be talking about the Electoral College votes, and I believe our North Dakota congressional delegation was not going to follow that particular route.
That's correct. They decided that they were all going to support the Electoral College votes as taken. And I thought that was, you know, it was a little bit courageous because all three are Republicans and they basically said, no, this was done fairly and squarely. There may be some questions, they said in the statements, that there might be some problems with potential fraud with some of the balloting, but they said nothing has been proven so far, so we see no choice except to approve the Electoral College.
And I note on the Minnesota side of the Red River that Michelle Fischbach, who took over Colin Peterson's seat in the 7th District of Minnesota, and Jim Hagedorn, both Republicans, actually did pursue that debate, if you will. They,
uh-huh.
They did ask for the audit of the
That's
electoral
right.
votes. But in the meantime, there has been a sort of a cooling of the relationship, the ardor, if you will, between some Republicans and President Trump.
Yes, you can say that again. Some of his staunchest supporters are basically saying, okay, enough is enough now. And even, you know, people like Lindsey Graham have said, you know, enough, we need to move on. Joe Biden is the president-elect. He will be inaugurated on January 20th. I have heard from some sources, not only here but in state capitals around the country, not necessarily North Dakota but Minnesota, for example, they're concerned that there may be another round of protests right around the inaugural. So it might be on the 20th. There might be another round of protests. So I know that there are things in place to keep not only the nation's capital safe but also, you know, some of these state capitals around the country.
Well, President Trump yesterday made a statement acknowledging the fact that Joe Biden is the president-elect. And today he has made another statement saying he will not be attending the inaugural.
And that's the first time since Andrew Jackson, I believe, would not attend the inaugural of his successor.
So history is made.
History is made.
We are shaking our heads at what happened earlier this week. Well, now let's talk about the other huge story that's dominated the last year or so, and that is COVID-19. North Dakota is faring much better, and the governor is going to relax some of the precautions.
Exactly. You're talking about 60% capacity in bars and restaurants and some waiving of some of the hour requirements. And there's some talk about moving more and more toward allowing athletic activities, and also, you know, some venues will be open. But if you have a venue or a bar, dance floors are still off.
Okay. Darn it.
I'm losing a lot of sleep over it. Not.
Well, you are a karaoke guy.
I'm a karaoke guy, but not a dancer.
Okay. Well, you help them dance. What the heck? And the mask mandate's going to stay in place until January 18th.
I see. And there's already some speculation that will he or won't he continue it? I'm guessing from what I'm hearing from sources is that he will continue it.
Well, we still have vaccinations that need to be taken. Now, I think North Dakota is doing okay in that area. It's other parts of the nation are struggling.
Right. And I just got something from Grand Forks County that they're going to be moving into phase 1B. So that is a good sign.
Well, that's
so now
great.
now they're expanding the pool of people who are getting vaccinated to the second tier, so to speak.
Well, as a 1C, I appreciate the movement my
yes.
way. Okay. The governor gave a very upbeat State of the State speech this past week.
He certainly did, and he used a lot of the speech to talk about we've gone through a real tough 2020, but 2021's looking a little better. And he is really, in that speech, pushing the idea of bonding. And I think this is going to be, if not the defining issue of the session, one of the defining issues of the session. Is there, A, going to be bonding, B, to what level, and C, what are they going to be the uses of bonding? There's been a lot of concern that there isn't enough money for infrastructure development. Bonding is going to help that. Now, so far you've got three competing bonding bills that are out there. You've got the governor at $1.25 billion. You've got the Republican majorities in the legislature at $1.1 billion. You have the Democrats at $2 billion. This is all going to get hammered out in conference committee. So we're a few months off on that yet.
Now, the governor also, of course, had this stabilization fund that he's talking about for higher ed.
And that kind of surprised me that he proposed that. Higher education has been pushing it for a while since they established the K-12 Education Stabilization Fund and the Budget Stabilization Fund. Higher ed has been saying we should do that too because we're worried about, you know, ups and downs all the time. Now there's going to be another proposal that will be discussed, I guess, and it was brought up 2 years ago for a Human Services Stabilization Fund so that services can continue without cuts. You have a rainy day fund you can dip into.
I was intrigued by a story that you posted today that there's been a bill introduced to curb executive power and give the legislature more say in emergencies.
Right, and it's one of two bills that are doing it. One bill talks about emergencies generally. The other one that's going to be pending in the House is just talking about health emergencies. And they'll say the governor can have his executive powers for the first 30 days, but after that, between the 31st and 60th day, you have to convene a legislative session so that legislators can weigh in on things like bar closings or mask mandates, that type of thing. It's very similar to what Minnesota does, from what I understand. Minnesota has a legislative session that has to be called every 30 days during an emergency like this, and then the governor's executive orders are either thumbs up or thumbs down.
Well, Minnesota also has annual legislative sessions.
That's correct.
I would also assume, though, that given what we've learned about how we can adapt during COVID-19, that legislative sessions can be somewhat online.
I think that's right. That's what they're talking about. And especially Senator Myrdal's bill says that these can meet remotely. And you know, I'm going to say something a little bit. I think North Dakota is at least par with a number of other states who have done that. But I'm thinking North Dakota is the head of the game because of how easy it is that you can participate remotely. They've got people who are at their homes or at their offices or offices in the Capitol, and they don't have to have everybody in the chambers because there is 6 feet social distancing. You are seeing really technology being used the way I think a lot of people thought it could be used, and North Dakota is proving you can do it.
And it makes it easier for us too, the citizens of North Dakota.
It certainly does, and I will admit it also makes it easier for news media, because in the press room, and Doug, I'm sure you're familiar with the press room.
I am.
In the Capitol. Those little kiosks where we sit, there just used to be you could plug in and switch between the House and Senate. Now they've got a box in there. You can dial the committee hearing rooms and you can listen to the committee without being in the room. That's the next best thing to being there, because I like being in committee rooms for some of the more tense hearings, because then you get a temperature of the room.
Yeah, you get that body language. You get the expression on the face.
Exactly, exactly.
People who aren't talking, who are looking in a certain way.
Right, but we're getting the stories out, which is a good thing.
All right. Well, I appreciate that. I think the citizens of North Dakota will as well.
I think so, too.
And meantime, the Public Service Commission is talking about public input sessions on Montana-Dakota Utilities and XL Energy's rate increases.
Right. MDU is a gas rate increase. XL's an electric rate increase. They're going to have public input sessions in early March one at noon, one at 5:30 on the 2nd. I think that's for MDU. On the 4th, it's going to be 12 noon and 5:30 for XL Energy. And these will be remote. I mean, they can log on to the PSC live stream and they can participate that way. We're going to more technology. And it's kind of interesting.
These are significant increases they're talking
Certainly
about,
are.
Though. $6.26 for a normal household on their gas bill.
Mm-hmm.
I assume that's monthly.
Yes, it is.
And then XL has sought a almost 11% electric rate increase.
Right. And they're both significant increases. And that's when they get to the technical hearings to take a look at the numbers. They've set aside several days for MDU, at least 2.5, and they think XL is going to be a lot longer. In XL's case, though, it has been a while since there has been a general rate increase. So they're going to have to go through a lot of documentation on this.
Well,
this is going to be a very intense and very involved hearing.
They'll likely get a fair amount of public input.
I think they will, too.
We check in with our news director, Dave Thompson, every Friday. Always a pleasure, Dave.
Thank you very much, Doug.
Hi, I'm Jack Russell Weinstein, host of Why, philosophical discussions about everyday life. The question why is very empowering. It's about the divine, it's about the moral, it's about the pleasurable, it's about fear. Why is everything? I'm not very good with authority and I'm not very good with limits. And so I like a question that gives me the ability to do whatever I want, whenever I want. I was born and raised in Manhattan on the edge of a neighborhood that most people would know as Spanish Harlem. I ended up in North Dakota because they offered me a job. It's that simple. And we've had a very good life here so far. Dispel these myths. Philosophy is boring. I guess I would ask you to ask yourself, are you boring? Do you think you have nothing of interest to offer anybody? You are philosophy. Philosophy is you. Everything you ask, everything you think, everything you want, everything you strive for, this is what makes up philosophy. Philosophy itself is compelling enough and exciting enough that it is pretty much the oldest discipline. And philosophers had more influence on the world than almost anybody. Plato, Aristotle, we live in their world. And so if you want to make philosophy exciting, you have to be exciting. Philosophy majors can't get jobs or make any money. Philosophy is the highest paid major of all of the humanities, and the rate of return is actually the same over a lifetime as engineering. Listen to Why, philosophical discussions about everyday life every second Sunday at 5 p.m. Central, 4 Mountain on Prairie Public.
It's time to go to the movies with Matt O'Lean. And Matt, this week, there's a movie that's in the actual movie theaters that's getting a lot of buzz, Promising Young Woman.
And it is deserving of its buzz, Doug. I really, really enjoyed this movie. It is one of the probably 4 or 5 best movies I've seen in 2020. I want to let listeners know I have not seen as many movies this year as I have in past years, primarily because I'm a big theater goer. And, of course, I may have to adjust myself to the new normal, depending on how theaters survive the end of COVID, as we hope it is coming to the end sometime this year with vaccinations available, hopefully, to the general public soon. Again, not many people at the theater when I went with my friend Brittany Goodman. This is directed and written by Emerald Fennell, and she is an actress from Great Britain who has used her friend Carey Mulligan in the lead. Carey Mulligan is certainly going to get an Oscar nomination for lead actress in this film. She plays a young woman who works as a barista and used to be a promising medical student. And we learn fairly early on that she is no longer in medical school. Now, the whys of why she dropped out of medical school, this is a kind of film I can't give away too many plot twists, Doug, and I wouldn't want to do that anyway. But it's ostensibly a movie about a dangerous game that Carrie's character plays with men. And it's all based on something that happened to her and a friend at medical school some years ago at a medical university called Forest. And this game that she kind of plays is very dangerous. I can't go into details of what it is. The film has been described by some as a female revenge film of sorts. But it's more than that, too. It's really kind of a cautionary tale of how we treat young men and young women in the same circumstance as they're climbing up the ladder to try to be successful in college life and post-college life and graduate school. The film really works for a few different reasons. We have a phenomenal performance by Mulligan first off. She is able to change her vocal pattern in a matter of a half a second or a second in certain scenes where all of a sudden she's playing a certain way and then all of a sudden her voice changes and you realize something is switched in her personality. Again, I can't get into too many details of how these scenes start and how they end, but they are based on the kind of revenge game that she is playing with men that she meets. Not only men that she meets, but men that may have been involved with her at the medical school years ago. We have a lot of great cameos: Alfred Molina, Adam Brody, Max Greenfield, Bo Burnham, who really has the secondary lead in this film as a former medical student that she went to medical school with that she meets randomly at the coffee shop. Where that goes from there also involves a huge plot twist. What I also liked, Doug, was I did not see a couple of the plot twists coming. I really didn't see them coming. Brittany did. She identified the plot twist about 20 minutes before it happened. I did not. I was so immersed in Carey Mulligan's performance and what was going on. But some of these cameos we get from kind of name actors like Alison Brie, Connie Britton, are one-scene cameos. They're one scene that Carey Mulligan's character has with these characters. And we get, you know, interesting cameos from sort of name actors. So it's really an interesting film. It's well edited. I love the shot selection that Emerald Fennell chose. We go from close-ups to tights to mediums and back. And really the shot selection kind of dictates the scene, how the scenes go as well. It's a terrifying film at parts. It's funny in parts. And you just are left kind of off balance by the way Emerald Fennell frames this story. You're not sure how to feel about everything you're watching. And I really like that aspect of it.
Promising Young Woman is the title of the movie. And I found out that the title is actually a play on a judge's comments about a young man on trial for sexual assault. This is some time ago. And the young man was given a relatively light sentence because, as the judge referred to him, he was a promising young man. So I think we can infer some of the storyline here.
Well, again, I don't want to give away too much to our audience listening because I want them to go see this movie. But yes, the promising young woman aspect not only is a play on words of Carey Mulligan's character Jess. She had a very promising career. It's also, as you know, can be the other way. This is a promising young man. We don't want to ruin his life. But again, I don't want to get into too many plot details that involve what happened at medical school because the audience has to figure it out for themselves. But yes, kind of that navigation of college life is so interesting, Doug, and it's so much more out in the open than it used to be when I was in college as to what goes on at frat parties, what goes on when too much alcohol is involved. And again, the game that she's playing 6-7 years after medical school is dangerous. It's intriguing. It's actually a plot line I've never seen before, so I really credit Emerald Fennell for that. I there have been films like this, which are ostensibly kind of a revenge type scenario to something or something that happened, but this actual plot device that Emerald Fennell uses, in terms of the plot device that Carey Mulligan's character Jess uses against these men that she finds and picks out, is something I had not thought about before. And so, again, I give them credit for showing me something I haven't seen on screen before. And Carey Mulligan, I think, should win the Academy Award. I'm going to go out right now and say it. Frances McDormand is great in Nomadland. Kate Winslet's great in Ammonite. Sidney Flanagan is great in Never Rarely, Sometimes Always. I think all four will be nominated. But I think Mulligan's performance is a little more showy. It's a little deeper. And McDormand has two Oscars, so I am campaigning for her right now to win the Academy Award.
All right. Well, that takes us to our Oscar trivia question this week. Carey Mulligan appeared in a 2011 movie that was directed by a person who would make Oscar history a few years later. Who is that person? I'll give you a hint. The movie was Shame in 2011.
So Steve McQueen directed that, and she was in that with Michael Fassbender, and McQueen went on to direct 12 Years a Slave, which won the Best Picture Oscar in 2013.
He was the first black man to win that award, and as a matter of fact, there were three Oscars given to 12 Years a Slave. What were the other two?
So I believe the screenplay, adapted screenplay?
Yes.
Yes, and Best Picture, and Best Supporting Actress, Lupita Nyong'o.
You've scored 100. Congratulations. We've been to the movies with Matt O'Lean.
When you hear arts programming here on Prairie Public, know that it is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, and we thank them.
We've got plenty of home-cooked podcasts for you to subscribe to. You want to bone up on Aristotle? Then subscribe to Why, Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life, hosted by UND philosophy professor Jack Russell Weinstein.
What's wrong with that argument?
Get to know the quiet, poetic grace of people, past and present, who make up our party region through Tom Easern's Plainsfolk essays.
Most of all, I'm thinking about that toothy fish.
And then there's the fascinating and diverse roster of guests on our daily statewide Conversation Convergence Main Street. The belly laughs and fun culinary insights of Sue Balcom on Main Street Eats.
We're getting chickens, but don't tell them that, okay?
Breaking Barriers, a Red River Rainbow Seniors LGBTQ podcast. And then there's the always popular and shareable Dakota Date Book. You can subscribe to any one or all of these Prairie Public podcasts through Apple, Spotify, Stitcher, NPR One, or wherever you like to get them.
This is Dakota Datebook for January 8th. On this date in 1909, the Washburn Leader informed readers of what one Grand Forks boy was up to. The newspaper reported that the young man kept a milk cow and some chickens. He spent his time reading poultry and stock journals. He made an average of $1.15 per day selling milk and eggs. He also sold his champion chickens for $5 a pair. The newspaper noted that his family always had milk, chicken, and eggs for the dinner table. Researchers at land-grant colleges recognized that young people were the future of agriculture. In the late 1800s, they had learned that adult farmers tended to be set in their ways and skeptical of new developments. Young people were more willing to experiment. In 1902, A.B. Graham started a youth club in Ohio. He called it the Corn Growing Club. About the same time, local after-school agricultural clubs caught on in many states. Young people were encouraged to actively participate in county and state fairs, exhibiting their livestock and produce. By 1912, the organization was called the 4-H Club. The movement was officially nationalized in 1914. The foundation of 4-H was to provide hands-on learning for youth in farming and homemaking. 4-H adopted a clover pin with an H on each leaf as the group symbol. The H's stand for head, hands, heart, and health. 4-H allowed young people to take field trips to destinations such as the Minnesota Grain Exchange. They were recognized for their accomplishments and often received substantial cash prizes. In 1931, a North Dakota 16-year-old was awarded $500 for his livestock judging skills. That would be $8,565 in today's dollars. In the early days of 4-H, boys focused on farming, while girls were steered towards homemaking. Today, young people learn a variety of skills. While at one time, 4-H was segregated with separate groups for white and minority students, the organization became integrated in the 1960s. North Dakota's 4-H is based at North Dakota State University. There's a club in every county. The goal is to provide activities for all young people to help them reach their full potential. Activities include educational programs, participation in county and state fairs, leadership activities, and camping. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Carol Butcher. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
When you take that social distancing walk or do chores around the house, I mean, you've got plenty of time for that, right? Put on your earbuds and immerse yourself in public radio content made just for you.
Hey, y'all, it's Sam Sanders, and welcome to NPR One.
Hourly newscasts from NPR and Prairie Public, your favorite podcasts, and your new favorite podcast. Plus, stories from Planet Money and Hidden Brain, coverage of the arts, and something we really need to be paying attention to these days, health and science. NPR One is personalized public radio content tailored to your interests, but you'll also hear up-to-the-minute news you need to know, like on the coronavirus.
That personalized balance is the heart and soul of NPR One.
It's just like the radio, but under your control. Download the NPR One app and listen.
Monday on Main Street, Secrets of the Viking Stone is a new show on Discovery's Science Channel. Peter Stormer is well known for his role in the Coen brothers' movie Fargo. He and history buff Elroy Bolgard have created a series about one of Minnesota's legendary controversies, the Kensington Runestone. Stormer will join us to talk about his show. We hope he can join us for Main Street on Monday, and we hope you'll check out Main Street Weekend, Sunday morning at 10 Central, will be presenting Persistence. It's an original radio play that is made possible by the North Dakota Women's Suffrage Centennial Committee. We hope you can join us for Main Street Sunday morning and Monday afternoon. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.